there's a different team in each school that deals with a different unit of the Constitution. Two of the six top awards went to Park Rose High School, which is unprecedented.
Nice.
Yeah. So congratulations to all those kids, but also to Hannah Backrack for moving on to the state.
Good job, Dad.
Nice.
This might get her to actually watch you guys on cable TV now. So.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Has anyone signed up to testify on this matter?
No one else signed up.
Is there any further discussion on council? If not, would you please call the roll?
Fish?
Well, I just want to say how delighted I am that Mr. Teske has agreed to serve another term, and really how honored we are, Mr. Widmark, that you've agreed to join the Housing Authority Board. And I think particularly as an elected city councilor, you will bring a level of prestige and access that we've not always enjoyed in building, developing policy with our sister jurisdiction in Gresham. Housing Authority of Portland is a bit of a misnomer because it is the Federal Housing Development Agency for the whole county, not just for Portland as a city. And anyway, thank you for your service. We look forward to working with you, and I'm pleased to vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you for your willingness to serve. Earlier this agenda, we approved on the consent agenda the volunteers for the Development Review Advisory Committee, and then you mentioning the We the People program that also is largely run by volunteers in the school districts. So Oregon is blessed by a wealth of citizens who are willing to give their time to make good things happen, and I vote aye with great appreciation.
Leonard?
Well, my congratulations, too, to Mr. Teske, and Jeff, congratulations to Hannah and her performance. But I really want to point out my appreciation for Councillor Widmark and his agreement to service on HAP, and observe that since I've been on the council, I have been responsible for the Bureau of Development Services, which includes a unit that goes out and enforces the housing code. And often against really derelict property owners. So I follow such things in other cities, and so I've followed closely your and Shane Mayor Bemis's efforts, which are nothing short of cutting edge to go after these derelict properties that are run by people who just use them as cash cows and don't keep them up. And we have modeled our changes after what you and Mayor Bemis have done out there. So I couldn't be happier to have you with that perspective sit on this board, knowing that it isn't just housing that's important, but it's decent housing. And it's having a place the people can be proud to live in. And so I really appreciate your efforts and Gresham's efforts, and talk about a lot. We were ably represented here today by Ed Merrihart, who runs that unit for Portland on another measure we're going to be talking about later. But we greatly appreciate your focus and your work and your service. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I want to thank Mr. Teske also, but I particularly want to thank, welcome Councillor Widmark to the Housing Authority Board. I've enjoyed working with you in the past on issues around regulating payday lending, and I know that you are an activist councillor, and that's great. We need people like that on the Housing Authority to keep Jeff Backrack on his toes. So pleased to support you. Aye.
Adams.
Thanks again. Aye. All right, if you could read the title for agenda item number 34.
Revise retail sales and service regulations for Division Main Street through the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package 4.
This is a second reading from agenda 5. You're here. Does council wish to ask any questions of staff? Unless this is a second reading, so unless I hear a need for council discussion, let's call the roll.
Fish?
Well, I appreciate all the constructive dialogue around this issue. We've had three substantive hearings, a lot of informative testimony, I think a very lively exchange at council. I was able to put the reasons on the record last week as to why I intend to support this proposal as modified by two changes which enhance the community consultation component and put a cap on the overall expansion of size. But as I said last week, I think this is good for the entire length of Division Street that it would apply to, and hopefully will create and jumpstart some economic activity on at least five opportunity sites that are now somewhat blighted. Aye.
Fritz.
I was really happy that this was on the agenda in my first council session last week, and it illustrates why for 17 years I've been so excited about participating in land use issues, because they are often cases in which reasonable people can and do disagree strongly, and we're able to talk about them and weigh the pros and cons. And sometimes we come back and say what we did before isn't working, and we would like to change it. And then if it doesn't work again, we can change it again. So I'm pleased to vote aye. I thank the neighbors and the business associations. Commissioner Leonard in particular made some excellent points last week. And we all remain strongly committed to citizen input, citizen process in land use decisions, and especially when there are discretionary decisions to be made, we want to make sure that there's the appropriate level of involvement. Sometimes we need to make it more clear and objective so that we can set standards and the development can move forward. And so I'm willing to vote aye on this, knowing that if there are future applications on the Division Street, there will be a report coming to council on what the neighborhood input was and how the developer's application was affected by it. Aye.
Leonard?
Well, although I think the council is making a mistake, I'm in a distinct minority, being the only one that believes so at this point. I cannot support this change because I actually think that the provision that was in the Division Street plan worked and worked as it intended. It was not, as it was characterized, creating unintended consequences. The unintended consequence specifically being that the Gold's Gym that was proposed was approved by BDS staff as it was proposed. It was appealed by not just the business but different neighbors in that neighborhood that utilized what the code said in terms of a appeal process and did that. Came back to the city, and we were fully prepared to permit the Gold's Gym as it was intended. What we've done, unfortunately, is the classic example of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. As the commissioner in charge of the Bureau of Development Services for about 6.5 years, the most frustrating job I have is to tell well-intentioned, balanced, and well-meaning neighbors they have no say in development in their neighborhood, literally, that by right certain kinds of developments can occur. This provision that we're unfortunately repealing today is the only and is a very unique provision that allows neighbors to have some say about what gets placed into their neighborhoods and specifically in their business districts. I will be watching this closely. I will go out of my way to drive home down Division to make sure that what was represented here happens, and I will not be shy in taking up my colleague's offer to relook at this repeal if something other than what has been represented here happens. No.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Adams.
Aye. Please read the title for item 35.
Amend and restate ordinance authorizing short-term subordinate urban renewal and redevelopment bonds.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners.
How are you?
Good.
Good.
I'm Eric Johansson, the city's debt manager. As you may or may not be aware, the Oregon State Constitution requires that we spend tax increment revenues only on, quote, indebtedness. And if you think about how tax increment revenues get applied by PDC, they both go in part toward the payment of debt service on long-term bonds, but they also go to pay projects on a pay-as-you-go basis. So in order to give PDC the ability to convert tax increment revenues into indebtedness to pay for pay-as-you-go projects, we need to have a financing program that accomplishes that conversion. And we refer to that particular program as de jure indebtedness. Why de jure? Because we borrow the money one day, we pay it back the next day. It creates indebtedness, and it allows us to be in conformance with the Constitution. So today's ordinance simply reallocates a $58 million annual authorization for de jure indebtedness among 10 of the city's urban renewal areas. Some districts' allocation is going up, some is going down, but in total, the $58 million limit stays the same. This ordinance doesn't change any, it doesn't fund any particular projects, it doesn't do anything to the budget. It simply allows PDC to pay for that portion of its budget on a pay-as-you-go basis through the tax increment revenues that are collected annually in each district. So that's the purpose of this ordinance. It's largely administrative in nature, but it does allow us to stay in compliance with the state constitution. So questions with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from council?
What's an example of a pay-as-you-go project?
I think typically it's going to be, it may be things that are very small that don't require long-term indebtedness. You know, we may tend to pay for things that would have to be done otherwise with taxable bonds. We may elect to do that with de jure indebtedness because it's less costly to do it with pay-as-you-go projects. So, you know, taxable projects, smaller projects, and just other projects that just don't lend themselves to long-term debt financing.
So many of the non-transit transportation projects are pay-as-you-go. It's rare for non-transit transportation projects to be financed by debt.
I'd never heard the term de jure indebtedness before.
Mm-hmm. It was created many years ago, and it simply reflects the fact that we go to, in this case, Key Bank, we borrow money one day, and we pay it back the next day with the tax increment revenues.
It's not a unique term to Portland.
Just to
Oregon. Just indebtedness. Okay.
Yep.
So we're essentially not creating more debt just for one day. We're not paying the advantage is that we're not then paying a lot of interest.
Correct. Yeah. We pay one day of interest at a pretty attractive rate.
Any other council questions, discussion? Anyone in the audience wishes to testify or anyone signed up?
No one signed up.
Not seeing any interest to testify. This is an emergency ordinance. Please call the roll.
Fish?
Aye.
Fritz?
This doesn't change any of the indebtedness. It's a mechanism to comply with the Constitution, which I think is a fine thing to do. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Please read item 36.
Add new provisions to address the exterior of non-residential structures, correct and clarify code language.
So, Commissioner Leonard.
Thank you. We have Ed Merryheart from the Bureau of Development Services. I want to give you a little background on what we're doing. As I alluded to earlier, Ed is in charge of the unit within the Bureau of Development Services that has often the unsavory task, not often, daily the unsavory task they are charged with, going out and making sure that housing and other nuisance kinds of issues in neighborhoods are cleaned up, brought up to code, and it is a hard job. But it is one of the most important things that the Bureau of Development Services does because it truly improves the livability of neighborhoods, and they have a number of cutting-edge programs that do that. What we've recognized over the years is that there are a number of commercial occupancies that have these same kinds of nuisance factors associated with them that we do not have the authority under Title 29 to address. This ordinance that we're voting on today amends Title 29 to give the Bureau of Development Services that authority. And we did this in cooperation with BOMA, the Building Owners and Managers Association, which is the private sector group that represents those kinds of commercial occupancies, which I think makes the point that responsible commercial property owners don't appreciate irresponsible commercial property owners that allow their buildings to be derelict or to be run down or not to be kept up, and that it detracts from their ability to run their retail businesses or commercial businesses in a responsible manner, not to mention what these buildings have done to the character of a number of neighborhoods. So it increases the workload for Ed and his staff, but I really appreciate them agreeing to take that on, and I think this will give us one more tool to improve the livability of Portland. Ed, do you have anything to add?
Good morning, Mayor and City Commissioners, and welcome to the new City Commissioners. I think Commissioner Leonard explained it very well. I really don't have anything additional to add other than I would like to also recognize the collaboration and partnership of some of the other groups that we work with. In addition to BOMA, we worked with the Small Business Advisory Council, SBAC, APNBA, and DRAC, the Development Review Advisory Committee, who supports this code change. Again, this code change is to allow us to enforce the existing exterior maintenance requirements on all non-residential structures in Portland, as Commissioner Leonard, to give us an additional tool and to help improve neighborhood livability and safety. And Again, we are going to be able to absorb this with our existing staff, as he mentioned.
And for the record, what was your name?
Edwin Merihart. I'm the program manager for neighborhood inspections who enforces Title 29 of the city's property maintenance code.
Thank you.
And I think that's all I have to say. If you have any questions.
Any questions from council?
Some examples of the types of things that we might see you enforcing on commercial structures?
Well, for example, a commercial building that is vacant, derelict, that has rain gutters draining onto the sidewalk, causing a nuisance, that would be an example. A vacant commercial structure that has peeling paint, siding coming off, missing siding. Some of the other exterior maintenance issues are exterior walls, exposed surfaces, maybe rotten stairs, porches, entrances to commercial establishments, missing handrails, guardrails, some other examples, some issues with chimneys, maybe chimneys, the bricks are loose and falling. So those types of things.
Okay, thanks.
Discussion from council? If not, is anyone signed up to testify?
No one signed up.
Is anyone in the room seek to testify? If not, this is a non-emergency and moves to next week's council for consideration.
And thank you, Ed. And I don't get a chance to say how much I appreciate the work you and your staff do. It's really amongst the hardest work in the city. It's not unlike the work of police officers without the uniforms, without the guns, without the all the tools that a lot of law enforcement has. And your folks are out there really representing the city in some of the most troubled areas, and I always greatly appreciate what they do.
Thank you, Commissioner Leonard, and we really appreciate your leadership and leading us in this. So, and I will pass it on to my fellow inspectors.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Leonard. All right, we're moving to the last item on the morning agenda here at the City Council. Would you please read item number 37?
Call special elections to fill the unexpired term of city auditor on May 19, 2009, and, if necessary, July 14, 2009.
Mayor.
Senator Blackmer, welcome.
Commissioners.
So, why are you leaving? is it because Amanda and I are now in different positions on the council? Is
that not at all.
Dan? It's Dan, isn't it? You had enough.
10 years is enough.
Yes. Commissioner. No. Oh, Randy's out of the room. It's Randy, right?
10 years is a long time. And there's a lot of different reasons. I mean, I think it's a good time for me to be leaving the office. The office is running very well right now. It's a good time to hand it off to another auditor. I'm excited about the new council and the big plans that you are all undertaking now. And I think it's good to have someone here who can follow through on those that, you know, 2 years from now, I will be leaving. I had not intended to run again. So that meant that I was on a different time horizon than you all were. And so I think that's another important reason. So, I mean, it's been a great pleasure to work here. It's been challenging, and I feel like I've accomplished a lot. And I'm really pleased with the, you know, the great professionals in the auditor's office and all that they've accomplished. And it's been a wonderful pleasure working with them and with you. So,
well, I'm really sorry to hear in that testimony that Randy Leonard chased you out of office. Oh,
it was a rather painful backroom session we had.
So tell us what
of which I was getting the pain, undoubtedly.
So Auditor Blackman, tell us what we're looking at today.
What you're looking at is a resolution to place the auditor's position on a May 19th special election. It's an election that's set aside by the state for things like special districts. So the school board elections will be occurring on that date. So it's something that the city of Portland can participate in, and it reduces the cost substantially from doing something that, even if it's a September or November, which are other recognized election dates, it's unknown that anyone will have any elections. And so it may cost us $85,000 to be on this race as opposed to $350,000 to $400,000 on a September race, and then an equal amount if there were need to be a runoff. So this would be a May 19th primary with a potential runoff on July 14th. And those follow the charter as closely as we can. Our charter election dates were set before we had mail ballots in the state. And because of military mailings, the county needs at least 45 days in order to mail those out. So we have to push the runoff date back an extra week and a half, I think, from the maximum allowed by the charter. But the charter does allow the council to delay the election if there is a reasonable basis for it. So that's what is before you. I brought Leslie Hildula with me, who's the chair of the Citizen Campaign Commission, because this does raise issues about public campaign financing. And they had a meeting on Monday night, discussed what they thought were some good accommodations for an auditor race. And so anyway, she could share those with you when we get done discussing this resolution, if you have any questions.
Well, if it's all right with the council, why don't we consider the implications for the public financing as we consider the ordinance? Is that all right?
Okay.
So, Leslie, if you could, I haven't had the time to dig into this much at all prior to this hearing. So if you could tell us, if we approve this resolution today, what is called for?
Well, this resolution only calls for the election.
I understand.
Based upon the conversation that, you know, we hear from you, I'll come back next week with specific ordinance that on a one-time basis will set up the special election provisions for the auditor. So it doesn't change the city code, but at this point, we'd really like to get your input also, so that
okay.
we can bring something forward.
So it doesn't automatically trigger something. You have to come forward and propose right. something for us to consider.
So right. what you bring us next week, will it include the special election and a runoff, or would there be two separate?
The provisions would address both of those.
It would.
Right.
So it would be appropriate today to discuss that
exactly.
as you're preparing. Okay.
Right. Yeah, I do need you to vote on this resolution
yes.
today so we can get it on the ballot.
Gary, it would be helpful for me in terms of context to know historically what kind of turnouts we've had in these kinds of elections in the past. Have you had a chance to look at that?
We've looked at it in the past. I'd have to go do some research on that.
I remember once living in another city when we had school board elections, which I faithfully voted in every year. The turnout rate was 1%.
As opposed to Caroline Kennedy.
I don't get
where did that come from?
What's that reference?
Where did that come from?
Well, you didn't read.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
She had a problem with voting.
Yeah.
But they were insignificant.
Who, by the way,
races.
I think should get the Senate appointment for the record.
Okay.
They were Senate races.
Commissioner Randy races. Leonard takes a position in the New York Senate appointment race.
But
blogger, stand by. She's definitely going to win now.
One of the...
there's a nexus there.
All right. I think you're asking the question.
One of the contexts for me to evaluate the numbers you're going to recommend next week is to have a better understanding of what the universe of potential voters is. Because one of the things we have to think about is, you know, how much does someone need to communicate with what universe?
Well, 2 years ago, I believe the turnout in May was something like 33%.
In an off year?
Yeah.
Okay. So you'll be glad to come
we
back
will
to
bring,
us.
We will get those. I'll email them to your offices
Thank
in
you very
advance.
Much.
Any mm-hmm. other requests of the auditor before
and
I hear from
so
Leslie?
I can hear from Commissioner Fish. Is the intent of that request by you to somehow help that mold what you think an appropriate amount should be for
Correct.
The... Okay.
The question I think we have to grapple with is how much does someone need to reasonably communicate with whatever the turnout? And my understanding of the overall system is that one of the reasons we do a bump in a November election from a May election is that there's a substantial increase in the universe of voters,
mm-hmm.
and therefore the cost of communicating with likely voters goes up. So I want to be able to correlate whatever figure we come up with to the universe of likely voters.
I see.
And if I might just set the stage for Leslie Hildula's presentation, the question is not should we have public campaign financing for this election. The code requires that. So in setting the date, the code has specific numbers for how much funding for a city auditor's position. What I am suggesting and what we're considering here is whether we would have an ordinance next week, which would have a public hearing and subsequent votes on whether we want to keep the current code provisions for the $150,000, which would be allocated, or whether we want to change that because of it being a special election.
So the code does have an automatic trigger. Does the automatic trigger require concurrence from council?
No. So unless we do something next week, it would be 150. And
but isn't it true that we would have to amend the current ordinance to extend the signature deadline?
No. The dates for qualifying are set by the auditor. By the auditor. So my office looks at the calendar and says, okay, this is going to be the date when you can start gathering qualifying contributions. This is the deadline. So the dates.
We change that in the special election in replacing Commissioner Stent. We had to adopt some.
Oh, it was basically calling in. I believe the code would say the May 19th for purposes of the current code is the primary. July 14th for purposes of the code is the general election. Just so that because, you know, the code says the May primary and the November general, because it's a special, we would say this is, you know, the May primary is considered.
We don't currently have regulations in the code for a special election, what the timing is, and you actually didn't change it for the.
That was kind of my point.
You left it at January 31st.
If we didn't do anything,
there would be nothing because there's no. But the code currently says that the auditor sets the dates for the qualifying period, etc.
For regular elections, but for special elections, it's silent.
Well, I believe. I mean, this would take the city attorney to.
He's ready to comment.
Oh, are you?
How handy.
go ahead.
I just want to be clear. All I'm trying to get to is if we did nothing, I assumed public financing would not be available.
The code directs the auditor to establish administrative rules pertaining to special elections. And the administrative rules identify that after the council sets the dates for the primary and the runoff, then the auditor shall adopt a schedule regarding qualification dates, et cetera. So this is not only that this is a triggering event for the auditor to adopt a regulation essentially setting those dates.
Well, I'm confused because I thought we had been having this issue of not having any rules for special elections.
Well, there are what are lacking are rules related to whether or not the amounts change in terms of the qualifying candidates, the amounts given to qualifying candidates during special elections. That's what's not in place. And that's what the ordinance next week will be addressing is an adjustment in those amounts.
You know, and I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but I thought I heard that if we did nothing, they would get whatever the ordinance says. My understanding is we have to actually affirmatively do something to create money for those candidates.
No. The code.
If we did nothing, they would get whatever the code says.
They would get what the code otherwise provides for elections.
And that's how much? The usual? Is it the mayoral or the city commissioner?
The city commissioner amount,
$150,000. Okay. So just to be clear for those mm-hmm. listening in, if we do nothing but pass this resolution, then there is a default that would go forward, $150,000 for the primary,
mm-hmm.
and $200,000 for the general. So unless we amend that, that would go forward. And all the other details, the auditor has administrative powers to set on his own.
So, Gary, when you ran for auditor at the various times, did you run three times?
In the county twice, in the city
council,
three times.
City council three times.
Three times.
What is the most you've ever spent in any of the one elections?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that I ran unopposed. So my campaign funds were like $600. But you know, I also know that
I can see your wheels spinning.
That's like Randy.
That's like Randy. Did you hear that?
What
he said? That's like Randy's campaign.
But we did have
raise a lot more.
We did have two contested auditor races at Metro and Multnomah County, and Metro, I believe, the top spender there was $45,000, and Multnomah County, it was a little over 40,000.
Which is a much larger group of voters in both those cases.
Conceivably. I mean,
Multnomah County is more
than sure.
The city and
right.
Metro
Turnout
is metro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like three counties.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I guess let me talk a little bit about, I guess, I don't try to talk about messages a lot because I don't think an auditor needs to dwell on appearance, and it's more about the reality of it. But occasionally messages are important, which is that I think the auditor has a key role in this form of government, that my role is to ensure that you all manage the city wisely and efficiently and effectively and equitably, and that diminishing the value of the auditor through public campaign financing budgets is, I guess, a message that I don't think is a good one to send to the public. I'm not saying that we need as much money, because frankly, the same people I contacted when I started running for the city that wrote $1,000 and $5,000 checks to commissioners and mayoral candidates wouldn't give me the time of day. And that was one of the reasons that I became more sensitive to public campaign financing, because they all talked about the importance of good governance, and that's why they were giving money to candidates. But I think that I stand for good governance also, and they gave me nothing.
But to the end that you, and I think we actually agree on this, to the end that you're suggesting we view our responsibilities as running an efficient government, I think the concern that I have is that I didn't vote for the campaign finance proposal, but I have supported, since it's been law, improvements to it and whatever I could. And so to that end, I just want to make sure we're efficiently running the system and make sure we identify an amount that's not irrational in the context of what has been spent for your position.
Well, and I agree with you, and I would also kind of tongue-in-cheek say that auditors can stretch their campaign dollars very wisely and efficiently. But at the same time,
touché.
one of the opportunities that auditors have to talk to the voters is through a campaign to educate them about the office. And reducing the candidate's ability to do that, I think, harms the office also.
So I think that's a good framing of the issues, and I would like to hear sort of what the Election Commission's thoughts are, and then we can have further. I'd like to get public testimony if anyone signed up, and we can have further discussion. Leslie.
Thank you. Leslie Hildula, and I'm the chair of the Citizens Campaign Commission. It's good to be here with you today, and I wanted to just take a moment to acknowledge the fact that the commission has been heavily involved in writing our report to you about the last election, and I want to thank you for your assistance and support in doing so. We, of course, were surprised to find ourselves in the middle of talking about special elections again and a bit dismayed, because we have so much appreciated the support and guidance from Gary. But we have wiped our tears, and we're tackling this task. And at our last meeting, we came up with some recommendations, and I want to thank the council for your leadership on this issue. We really appreciate it. We understood from the city attorney that we don't need to work, that public funds are available, that the qualifying period is established to start January 15th. And end on the filing date of March 10th. This would be the filing deadline, which makes a lot of sense, because if you set up the qualifying period to be the same as the filing deadline, then you don't have to worry about candidates still trying to get qualifying signatures at a time when debates are being scheduled or camp balloting material is being prepared, which happened in our first round of elections, where we had candidates who weren't invited to all the appropriate forums because they weren't recognized as qualified candidates. Second of all is that we'd like to maintain the existing city code regarding the 1,000 qualifying contributions. We saw these past elections, two people raised more signatures, more qualifying contributions than that in less time. So it's a high standard, but we believe in having high standards to earn public funds. So that's maintaining existing code. The third thing is the spending limit. Recognizing that $150,000 is a lot more money than auditors have seemed to need for their races, and recognizing that it's a short period of time since it's a special election, and that there seems to be a desire to reduce the amount of money that are spent on campaigns rather than the opposite. We're suggesting recommending a $50,000 spending limit. And $50,000 doesn't sound like a lot for a citywide race, as you all know. I think some of you have some experience that you can share with us about what $50,000 can do in a citywide race. And I'll let you share that with each other since that's your expertise. The one thing that came up for us when thinking about $50,000 and that low amount is the idea of matching funds. So if there's a hotly contested race and spending is going above $50,000, the matching funds of an additional $50,000 would be available to that publicly funded candidate, which would get them to a limit of $100,000, which if you look at past records, as Gary mentioned, of races running more between $30,000 and $45,000, that seems like you're not penalizing a publicly funded candidate by underfunding them, but by giving them $50,000, you're also recognizing that that is probably a very adequate amount of money. And then the fifth thing is that the seed money limit be $5,000, which is 10% of the spending limit, which maintains existing city code, and that the in-kind contribution maintains existing city code at 6% of the spending limit, which would be $3,000 for the May runoff. This is all in an email that you received from Andrew Carlson. So the only modification, enhancement to existing city code that we're recommending that you do next week is the spending limit of $50,000 and plus matching funds.
And then that's for both the primary and the general, total 50?
We're recommending $67,000 for the general. And what we're looking at are rational ways of looking at this, patterns that, because realize we're setting precedents here. Basically, we have case law, which is not a bad thing. We're looking at one-third the spending limit. So that would be $50,000 for the May race and $67,000 for the July race.
Questions for Leslie?
Leslie, I appreciate that we're having this conversation before someone has filed and before someone has announced, because I think it's terribly important that we set the ground rules before people throw their hat in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, that's created, I think, some of the complexity of trying to make adjustments in midstream. So I appreciate your work at the front end of making recommendations. I also appreciate the comment you made about the matching funds, because I think it often gets lost in the debate. The floor, the amount that we agree to in terms of the amount of public financing is basically a floor, not a ceiling, if a privately financed candidate comes in and decides to spend as much as they want, because what the system does is it compensates a publicly financed candidate to match what a privately financed candidate is spending, so that in effect, it makes sure that a publicly financed candidate is not at a disadvantage. And frankly, it works the other way, I think, more effectively, which is it discourages people from just spending wildly, knowing that what they're doing is essentially fundraising through a public mechanism for their opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So on those two points, I appreciate your comments. And what I would appreciate some clarification from you on is the rationale that you've used for the two figures. The $50,000 in the primary, I understand the logic of that,
mm-hmm.
and I understand you've looked at some past races, and we can have that discussion. My understanding, though, is that in the runoff, which would be in July,
mm-hmm.
if should there be a runoff, I mean, we're planning, but there are not always runoffs, as we know from history.
Mm-hmm.
In a runoff, my understanding is there'd be a smaller pool of voters than in a May primary, and
mm-hmm.
partly because it's one of those occasional non-scheduled, irregular voting periods. And I think the other complication is it falls smack dab in the middle of the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Not the best time to actually be getting the public's attention on an election, and it's not a historical time that people are used to voting. Am I correct that the turnout is likely to decline in a runoff over the primary, number one? And if so, If I am correct, why would you be recommending more dollars in a lower turnout election?
Two reasons from how I understand it. One is that just because you have a lower turnout doesn't mean you don't have to work harder to get that turnout. And in fact, it could even be harder to get that turnout if you don't have a lot going on the ballot. And second of all, it's a matter of following the pattern of we provide a certain amount of money for the primary, we provide a little bit more for the general, and so we're following that pattern.
So that's a good point, and that's something that I want to learn more about between now and next week. And one of the reasons is that when we talk about a smaller turnout, what I've learned in my experience as a candidate is that when the turnout gets smaller, what we do is we tend to look for the key indicators of who's likely to vote. And what we often do is we look to so-called 4-4 voters, mm-hmm. people who have been very attentive to voting, right. Unlike Carolyn Kennedy, to anticipate my colleague's
comment. She wouldn't get one of your mail-ins.
And so you'd look at people who religiously vote, mm-hmm. and you'd be looking at the profile of people who vote religiously in certain kinds of elections. For example, we know that older voters tend to be overrepresented in the May primary. That there's just a pattern of older voters voting. So that's one of the. So coming back to the point about why there's more money in a runoff than in a primary, while the pool would get smaller, my guess, and it's just anecdotal, is that it's actually easier to target in a runoff because you'll be looking at the hardcore that vote in any election, and that's your basic 4-4 voters with some demographic overlays. So I just food for thought, and I haven't come to a conclusion on the dollar amount for the runoff, but that's something that I'm struggling with.
And I think one of the challenges is going to be there were so many new registrants last year that we don't know. We found it difficult even between May and November predicting how many of those folks were going to continue to vote. I mean, obviously, in November, there was a high turnout. But because there were so many new registrants last year, they haven't had four elections to get on that 4-4 list, and yet they may be voting. So the targeting actually is going to be really challenging if there's a runoff, and perhaps more of that money would go to staff who would be expert in figuring that out rather than the actual mailings.
So it might be useful to, when you come back next week, to show us that targeting, which you can get from a variety of vendors. They'll provide it to you virtually free, the 4-4s, the 3-4s, and then the new voters.
If I could just add to that, in light of your comments, Gary, about not wanting to degrade an auditor's race, do you have a current opinion on the recommendation from the Citizens Campaign Commission on the 50-67 split?
I guess, I mean, from the standpoint of I don't, in the sense that we can speculate back and forth. At a certain point, I try to get down to what are the important decisions that need to be made, and a $17,000 difference from the standpoint of just what the council's dealing with. It's up to you folks. I really don't want to kind of weigh in on that. You know, from my perspective, the $50,000 would be sufficient.
For the primary?
For the primary. I think it could be sufficient for the runoff, but from the standpoint of just trying to maintain the spirit of what the code had, you know, that was really the thinking that the Citizen Campaign Commission had, and it's as reasonable a basis as all the voter behavior theories that are floating around out there.
And finally, if I could you remind us again in this public hearing, what are the minimum qualifications for someone who seeks the position that you're vacating?
Good question. The person has to be a registered voter of Portland. They don't have to vote, but they need to be a registered voter. They need to be a resident of Portland. They need to have professional certification, either certified internal auditor, certified public accountant, or certified management accountant.
Are those state certification?
National. And actually, the certified internal auditor is international.
So we have two people that
have
been
asked any questions. Do you mind if I?
Oh, I was going to take testimony and more discussion. We got people waiting, but you go ahead.
Well, we have these witnesses here, so I'd like to
better
understand.
They'll stick around, too.
So I need to better understand the first I heard of the matching proposal was you articulated it here. So does that mean that one could qualify for the $50,000 through signatures and then privately raise another $50,000?
No. Well, with the public fund system, every candidate has the initial amount of money to run their campaign. And then if their opponent spends above that amount.
And we would match that.
Yes, so up to a limit, though. It just doesn't go on forever. And in this case, it would be an additional $50,000. So the opponent could spend $200,000, but mm-hmm. the publicly funded candidate only would get $100,000.
$50,000 from us and, well, $100,000 from us.
We initially match, $50,000, yeah, and then and the other up to a possible $50,000 more.
Okay. And I guess the in the context of Gary explaining to us that the most that has been spent on an auditor's race, notwithstanding the city of Portland, but at the county or metro, has been something in the $43,000 range. I just want to say that I'd like the amount to be reflective of some scientific methodology, to the extent that we can. As Commissioner Fish first asked the question about the number of voters that we project, and we have a pretty good science, notwithstanding new registrants and all that. I mean, the Secretary of State's office and I think our county elections folks have been always within a couple percentage points of predicting that for both the initial election and the runoff. That would be the methodology that would be most attractive to me.
One of the things that was talked about at the commission meeting around this number was the cost of doing a mailing mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. a very modest cable TV ad campaign.
I would be more inclined to be attracted to the cost of doing a mailing, given that the whole thrust of this program is to level the playing field. I have a deeper reservation that this program actually, for the auditor's race especially, could mm-hmm. make the playing field unlevel for an otherwise qualified candidate who didn't have the organizational structure to get the signatures. They would be struggling around $600 or $1,000 in contributions, according to the auditor, while somebody we funded would get $50,000. That's just a sure. troubling aspect. Secondly, what has bothered me about the discussion about the program to date is not everyone talking about it in the context of the larger responsibility that Gary alluded to, that the council has to balance our budget and to fund essential services. So this time upcoming, I will just project for you based on my experience, Commissioner Fritz has the Office of Neighborhood Health Involvement and 911 Center, General Fund Bureaus, they're going to take hits. I have the Fire Bureau, General Fund Bureau, it's going to take hits. Dan Saltzman has Police Bureau, it's going to take hits. So for me, when I vote on stuff like this, whether it's in a tax abatement, and I've preached on this since I got here, that tax abatements should be considered expenditures, and that's money not otherwise available to us. This is the same thing. I will make this decision not exclusively absent of those other mm-hmm. Budgetary concerns, but in the context of this upcoming budget season. So if it's not a number that's based on a specific methodology that's well thought out and efficient and meets those tests, I can't support it. So I hope that I hope in your deliberations you all consider that, because I'd like to be able to support it.
Thank you.
Anything else?
I'd just like to ask a little Blackman, as far as the campaign finance fund, do we still have money in the fund?
We have more than sufficient money for the next, not only this special election, but the next round as well. And at this point, we're requesting $320,000 total to be added to the fund. And the ratio, a little less than half of that, is general fund money.
Thank you.
In the upcoming budget year. Mm-hmm.
Anything else from council? All right. Thanks for
Thank you.
And if you could stick around, we've got three people signed up to testify. If you could call the first three.
We have Jason Worcester, Carol Cushman, and Chris Smith.
Good morning. Thanks for spending some time with us today. You have please state your name, and you each have 3 minutes. Carol? Somebody?
Who signed up first? My name's Jason Worcester.
Hi.
I can appreciate the desire of City Council to save the cities of Portland, or the citizens of Portland, an estimated $270,000 by rushing to fill Mr. Blackmer's vacancy with a special election on May the 19th. However, I'd like to share the true cost of denying us a general, a genuine, and normal election cycle. There are 61,389 new Portland voters since the last auditor's race. Most of these new voters do not know the intricacies of the commission system, nor are they aware that the auditor is the only elected representative who is the sole system of checks and balances. The resolution you are voting on today does not provide enough time needed to allow candidates to effectively connect with and educate voters. 47,648 voters are younger than 28 and have never had the opportunity of participating in a contested open seat auditor's race. 109,422 voters have never cast a ballot in the past 10 years for all odd year special elections. The resolution before you today is antithetical to increasing civic participation by shortening the time to allow citizens to be a part of the electoral process. With three of your five votes, you are effectively denying tens of thousands of Portland voters the opportunity to learn about the services of their auditor. More so, by limiting the time to this election, you are undermining the rights granted by Article 5 of the City Charter to elect an independent professional who respectfully keeps you five in check. Though I believe your actions are to be good intentioned in these hard economic times, please do not be misled. What you are doing in the name of saving money is devaluing our democracy. With your hasty actions now, you are severely limiting the citizens of Portland, their right to democratically interact with those seeking to be the individual that can legally hold you accountable. It is my concern that the proposed auditor special election will raise questions of legitimacy for this council in the future. Each one of you has the responsibility of spending our money appropriately and using resources effectively. Each one of you also has a responsibility that supersedes thrift, and that is to provide voters ample time to educate ourselves in electing an individual who will protect the integrity of our government by maintaining an uncompromised system of checks and balances. As one of the 320,027 voters in the city of Portland, I will gladly pay my share of the true monetary cost of 80 cents per City Code Section 2-206B to have an election 90 days after the office of the auditor is vacated. This will allow for an informed electorate to participate in an equitable and fair election. Thank you.
Thank you.
A question.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you know about the turnout in a September. So you're asking for a September election rather than a May?
What I'm really asking for is more time to educate voters. 90 days is what city code says. Unless there's an unreasonable circumstance, you can go on beyond that.
But the charter says we can have elections March, May, September, and November.
That may be.
So I'm just wondering if you know have we had elections in September before? And if so, would the turnout be likely to be higher than in May?
I don't know that data.
Okay.
I was on the ballot in September, and it's not.
I appreciate
it's not any higher.
It's lower.
It's lower
significantly.
I appreciate your comments. I would just offer two observations. One is that I believe there's a charter-based requirement that we fill vacancies promptly, and one of the challenges here is that we don't want to have the vacancy in a position of this importance for a period of time. We have to balance that because if there's no city auditor for a period of time, then it's sort of like a headless horseman, and that has significant consequences in terms of checks and balances. But the other thing I want to reassure you about is that I was in a similar special election recently. Jumped into a race in early January. It was a four-month cycle. I have never filled out so many written questionnaires from so many groups that asked questions that were, at first blush, well beyond my capacity to answer. So I was spending most of my time doing homework. I participated in a city club debate, neighborhood debates, coalition debates, League of Women Voters debate. I mean, there were, I can't tell you how many events. And I will also tell you that all the newspapers summoned me and the other candidates for interviews. I actually think after 4 months, people were sick of us. But it places burdens on the system. But my impression was that if a citizen wanted information about that race, wanted to attend a forum, wanted to have access to a candidate, the system worked, that people did have ready access. It's not ideal, and I think, you know, but the announcement's been made about a vacancy, and I just want to tell you, one of the things we have to balance is it good for the city to have a vacancy in the auditor's position in order to meet this equally compelling objective of giving people more time to review the candidate?
If I may respond. And respectfully, Commissioner Fish, you had two prior terms to run as well to get name recognition, and a lot of the people of Portland already know about the commissioners. However, when you ask about the auditor, it's more about education and time and that person-to-person connection, and actually having candidates interact is educating and making our government stronger. So that's my concern, is that there's not enough time. And the purpose of elections is not only to elect someone to office, but it's also to educate the citizens, just as you had mentioned with the We the People program. So elections are one of the best ways to educate the citizens. And by shortening it, you're actually limiting the time in which our citizens can become educated.
Thank you.
Carol Cushman. And actually, I am not here speaking for myself or for my normal organization. I am reading a statement for someone else. This is from Janice Thompson, who wasn't able to be here today. Thanks to Carol Cushman for conveying these thoughts, since I cannot be there in person due to illness. Democracy Reform Oregon supports Citizen Campaign Commission's recommendations and greatly appreciates Commissioner Fritz's work on the special election issue. The May timing means that an election will be occurring when people expect one, and the auditor replacement process will be prompt. The dollar amount reflects campaign spending going farther in a quiet election season. And on an added note, I will be back next week with a statement from the usual suspects.
Thank you, Karen.
Chris Smith, and I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge this is my first opportunity to testify before Commissioner Fritz in her new capacity as a former opponent and current fan. I wanted to publicly congratulate you and welcome you to the State Council. I want to speak to two points. First, on the timing, I actually had a different concern about the timing, which was whether there was adequate time to get 1,000 contributions. And I'm delighted to hear that the deadline is March 10th rather than January 31st. Now, my experience was we had about 4.5 months starting in September with a January deadline, and we got 60% of our contributions in the last 30 days. So clearly the deadline focuses the contributors. I think the 50-plus days that this allows is probably sufficient. So I feel pretty good about the timing. Because Commissioner Leonard brought up the issue of the general fund and the real challenges the city is going to have with the general fund, I just want to make a clarifying point, which I know Commissioner Leonard understands, but people at home watching may not. Voter-owned elections is not funded exclusively from the general fund. It is, in fact, a small percentage tax on the all-funds budget, all the city functions and revenue streams across the budget, just as your salaries are paid from that same kind of an allocation. So the impact of voter-owned elections on the general fund is actually relatively small. Not that you don't have legitimate challenges in dealing with the general fund. I just want to make sure that the people who are listening to this debate are educated to the way that this program is actually funded. So, thank you.
Thanks.
I would just question. Gary just testified that he would budget a little over $150,000 from the general fund this upcoming year. And while in the grand scheme of things, it may not be characterized as a lot of money, it still is impactful on particularly smaller general fund bureaus. Owning, for an example, would take a huge hit. Is going to take a huge hit, as all general fund bureaus do. So I didn't mean to suggest it was exclusively funded by the general fund, because in the water bureau we can raise rates, and the DES they can raise rates, and it isn't the challenge that you have when you're taking money out of the general fund. And, it's an approach that I try to take, irrespective of what the issue is or the budget is or the item is, to make sure we're always getting the most amount of efficiencies out of our dollars.
Commissioner Fish?
Chris, I had a question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the 1,000 signature threshold and the time frame in which to get. Could you remind us, what was your method for getting the signatures?
Twofold. One was to activate the network of people that I've built relationships with in the community over my volunteer activity for a decade and ask them to solicit their friends and neighbors on my behalf. The second component, and probably in the end I would say they were probably close to 50-50, was I went to where I thought there were voters who shared my values and beliefs or concerned about issues, whether that was standing on the Hawthorne Bridge flagging down cyclists or going to neighborhood meetings, but finding concentrations of